This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by Ian Skelly.
Commemorations for the victims of the September the 11th attacks are taking place in New York. Bells will toll across the city at just after a quarter to two, the time the first plane struck. The Florida pastor who planned to burn some copies of the Quran, Terry Jones, has arrived in the city. It's thought he's planning to meet the imam, who wants to build an Islamic center near Ground Zero. After the official commemorations, rallies will take place both for and against the planned center. A British soldier has died in hospital in Birmingham after being shot in Afghanistan last month. He was from 2nd Battalion, the Duke of Lancaster's regiment, serving as part of 1st Battalion, the Royal Gurkha Rifles Battle Group. His family has been told. The official in charge of the tax system has said he won't apologise after 6 million people had the wrong amount of tax taken. Dave Hartnett, the permanent secretary at Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, said stories of blunders at the department were wrong. The Conservative MP, Ian Liddell-Granger, accused HMRC of built-in arrogance. Three people have been arrested after a shoe was thrown at the Greek Prime Minister, George Papandreou, in Thessaloniki. Mr. Papandreou was at the city's annual trade fair, where trade unions were protesting against the government's spending cuts. The Australian Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, has unveiled her new cabinet. Ms. Gillard, who was born in Wales, is leading the first hung Australian federal parliament in 70 years. The new foreign minister is Kevin Rudd, who was deposed as Prime Minister before the election. Police are appealing for help to find a mugger who stole a handbag from a woman in Birmingham which contained the ashes of her father. The attack happened last week in King's Heath. The suspect is a white man in his late teens. And the weather for this afternoon, there'll be rain across southeast England with scattered showers across the rest of the UK. Most areas will have some sunny spells and temperatures should stay warm. And that's the BBC News and the weather. It's 2 minutes past one.
And it was read by Ian Skelly. Well, now on Radio 3, as part of the BBC Focus on Opera, this month's early music show, Opera Profile. And today we find Lucy Skeeping walking the streets of London.
I'm standing in one of London's busiest areas, not far from the Covent Garden Piazza, that great magnet for the serious shopaholic. I'm just about halfway down St Martin's Lane, a narrow, oldie-worldy kind of street that opens up at one end into Trafalgar Square, and at the other joins the northern bit of Shaftesbury Avenue, an almost continuous traffic jam. But this particular point in the road has its own very special story to tell. I'm at a place where seven roads meet, a junction known since it was built at the end of the 17th century as the Seven Dials. And here in the centre of this almost cosmic arrangement, an imposing stone column, complete with, yes, I can see them up there, seven sundials. From the early 18th century, the area became famous for its print shops, dingy outlets that produced penny pamphlets and broadside ballads that featured everything from the latest news, royal gossip or political hype to salacious stories of sex or domestic strife. Here, right where I'm standing, among the clattering din of horses' hooves, the shouts of street traders and the drunken groans of beggars, one would no doubt also have heard a rendering of the latest ballad, hot off the press, sung, or more likely bawled, by one of London's army of rough ballad peddlers.
Now when I was a bachelor I led a merry life, but now I am a married man and troubled with a wife. I cannot do as I have done because I live in fear. If I but go to Islington, my wife she watches there. Give me my yellow hose again, give me my yellow hose, for now my wife she watches me, see yonder where she goes. Apprentice bound and my indentures made. In many faults I have been found, but never thus afraid. For if I chance now, by the way, a woman for to kiss, the rest are ready for to say,
my wife shall hear of this.
Give me my yellow hose again, give me my yellow hose, for now my wife she watches me,
BBC Yonder where she goes. Thus, when I come in company, I pass my mirth in fear, for one or other merrily will say my wife is there. Then this doth make them all to laugh, to see my woeful face. How I stand like John, hold my staff, and dare not show my face. Give me my yellow hose again, give me my yellow hose. For now my wife, she watches me, see yonder where she goes.
Douglas Wootton and The City Waits with The Merry Jest of John Thompson and His Wife, one of the Roxburgh collection of ballads, begun in the late 1600s and now housed in the British Library. Broadside ballads and the tunes to which they were sung were really the pop songs of their day. Whistled and hummed in all walks of life, these flimsy sheets of paper with their simple woodcut illustrations were as likely to be bought for domestic amusement as pinned up on a tavern wall. Some eventually found their way into the libraries of antiquarians like Samuel Pepys or the Earl of Roxburgh and preserved for posterity. Others ended up as cheap book liners, draft excluders or toilet paper. By the late 17th century, hundreds of ballads were being churned out in London every day by anonymous hacks, often working from the back of print shops. They reported the whole gamut of life, from the stern phrases of the Puritan moralist to the bawdy jests of the rude country bumpkin or the cynical antics of the rakeabout town. And they were often as sensationalist as today's tabloid newspapers. No criminal worth his salt was executed without a printed broadsheet proffering his last words to the world, often even before he'd uttered them. The broadsheets were collected from the printers each day by an army of rough peddlers, scurrilous fellows as they were described, who, often working in leagues with gangs of pickpockets, travelled the length and breadth of the country, selling them alongside ribbons, buttons and general knick-knacks. One of the challenging aspects for anyone interested in singing broadside ballads these days is the fact that hardly any of them were printed with music. Below the title is a simple instruction to the tune of, say, Green Stockings, which is what we're hearing now, a tune that everyone will be familiar with. Luckily for us, though, many of the tunes are preserved in other sources. The Complete Dancing Master, for instance, published in the 18th century, or hidden, perhaps, within some complex arrangement for, say, virginals or viol consort by composers like William Byrd or Thomas Morley. Other tunes turn up in contemporary anthologies, like Thomas Durfey's Pills to Purge Melancholy, published in 1720.
When I was in the Low Country, when I was in the Low Country, what slices of pudding and pieces of bread my mother gave me when I was in need. My mother, she killed a good fat hog, she made such puddings would choke a dog, and I shall never forget till I die what lumps of pudding my mother gave me. She hung them up upon a pin, the fat ran out and the maggots crept in. If you don't believe me, you may go and see what lumps of pudding my mother gave me. And every day my mother would cry, come stuff your belly until you die. 'Twould make you laugh if you were to see what lumps of pudding my mother gave me. At last I rambled abroad, and then I met in my frolic an honest man. Quoth he, my dear filly, I'll give unto thee such a pudding you never did see. Said I, honest man, I thank thee most kind, and that which he told me indeed I did find. He gave me a lump which did so agree. One bit was worth all my mother gave me.
Come to the site of one of the most notorious establishments of 18th century London, Newgate Prison, and I'm joined by Vanessa McMahon, Doctor of History at Birkbeck College here in London. Now, Vanessa, the subject of many of the ballads was in fact crime and punishment, so I think it's rather appropriate that in front of us we can see the Central Criminal Court, or as they say, the Old Bailey. That's all that's left of Newgate, really, I suppose. But what would it actually have been like, say, around the 1720s here?
Well, the short answer is it would be horrible. It would be dirty, very noisy, much as it is today, but not necessarily with traffic noise, although of course there would be traffic noise. The city was becoming very much the city of the vehicle, so there would be lots of carts and lots of horse noise, for example, and also lots of bustle. Although it was a prison, although our modern conception of a prison is a closed off space that people don't really access, or you only access when you have your visiting order, for example, this is somewhere that people would be accessing all the time, that they would expect to be able to go into.
Was this a special place that you got sent to if you were really notorious, or was it just one of many kind of prisons around London?
Well, there were many prisons around London, and of course lots of people come here for very petty crimes. Even children would end up committed to Newgate, but you would only be committed here whilst you're being held over for your trial. So of course when you think about Newgate, you need to think about its proximity to the Old Bailey, to the old session house, not the modern one obviously, and of course this would dominate. So you would have the holding cell, and then you would have this site of justice just down the road, which of course could condemn you.
My masters and friends and good people, draw near and look to your purses, for that I do say. And though little money in them you do bear, it costs more to get than to lose in a day. You oft have been told by the young and the old, and bid and beware by the cutpurse so bold. Then if you take heed not, free me from the curse, who both give you warning for and the cutpurse. Youth, thou hast better be starved by thy nurse than live to be hanged for cutting a purse.
How much did this building, this terrible prison, this stinking place, kind of loom over people's thoughts? I mean, was it really something in a way that, I suppose, stopped them themselves going into crime?
In theory, this is the entire point of the criminal justice system, that you have an ominous prison, that you have an open court, and that you have a very open execution. That's the point. You stop people committing crimes. Of course, it doesn't work like that at all. And most people really enjoy it. It's a great day out. They take the children, take the whole family to watch all of the executions, and they have fun. And of course, they give all the proper moral lessons to their children and to their neighbours and agree. But at the same time, they're having snacks, they're buying pictures of the execution.
And of course, as we can see in some of those fantastic Hogarth prints, they draw huge crowds. And indeed, there were many people selling ballads, selling broadsheets, sometimes with the speech. I remember one particular one with the speech, the last words of the guy going to be hanged, being sold, or obviously before he'd even spoken them.
Yes, yes. Well, these are called last nine speeches, and it's big business, it's huge business. In fact, particularly here at Newgate, where the ordinary at Newgate, the chaplain at Newgate, would make a fortune writing out the last nine speeches, and eventually this becomes the Newgate calendar, which is of course compiled by a series of ordinaries rather than just one ordinary at Newgate. And they write them down and record them, and of course they greatly edit them, because you have to sound suitably chastised, suitably sorry for your actions. And of course you have to say all the right things, all the right moral things. You know, take me as an example. You know, I didn't go to church on Sunday, I fornicated with women, and look where I am now. You know, I should be your example, and therefore you should never do these things. And of course, most people took the salacious bits and carried on fornicating and not going to church and doing all the things they shouldn't be doing.
And set them to music sometimes.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Great fun.
at plays and at sermons and at the court sessions. Tis daily our practice such booty to make, yea, under the gallows at executions. We stick not the stare about purses to take, nay, one with a brace at a better place, at court and at Christmas before the king's face. Alack, then for pity must I bear the curse that only belongs to the cunning cut purse. Youth, thou hadst better be starved by thy nurse than live to be hanged for cutting a purse.
A warning to cut purses, a broadside ballad to the ever-popular tune known as Packington's Pound. While ballads and dance tunes like that were popular across the board, the really smart folk, of course, headed in their leisure time to the big London theatres for that most exclusive and exotic of entertainments, Italian opera. And in this field, it was Handel who made such an important contribution. As the new musical director of the opera company known as the Royal Academy of Music, he set out in search of the finest singers in Europe to present to the English public. Even before 1700, Londoners had been fascinated by the castrati that they'd heard in concerts, and Vanbrugh's new theatre in the Haymarket, known as the King's, was soon devoting itself exclusively to Italian operas in which these strange phenomenons of nature could show their voices. With this kind of quality singing on offer, Londoners rapidly discarded their own operas, or more accurately, their plays with songs, in favour of Italian ones, although, of course, they were sung in a language hardly any of them understood. Handel's operas depended much less on scenery or dance than the earlier efforts of, say, Purcell, and consisted almost entirely of arias and recitatives to display the beauty of the human voice. In 1723, he began work on Julius Caesar. Here he was aiming at a result that would be more magnificent, more epic in every sense of the word, than anything he'd done so far. It was a great success, one observer commenting that the house was just as full at the seventh performance as at the first. For the final part of my journey, I've come to Lincoln's Inn Fields, not far from the Aldwych and the Strand, and I'm joined by musical historian Jeremy Barlow.
It was actually on this site, wasn't it, that one of London's theatres stood, the Theatre Royal. And it was here in the 1720s that a rather groundbreaking production was mounted that owed a lot to the broadside ballad tradition.
Yes, that's the Beggar's Opera, written by John Gay, and actually a kind of reaction to Italian opera. It really opposes Italian opera from the very beginning with its title, The Beggar's Opera. I mean, beggars haven't got anything to do with opera as in Italian opera. Italian opera was visited by the nobility and gentry, and the subject matter were people like Julius Caesar, but here we have a beggar writing an opera, and his main character is a highwayman, the criminal, Captain McKeith.
Well, the whole thing is kind of set up by a character who describes in a speech before the overture starts exactly what's going on.
That's the beggar, and he says that he wrote the opera to celebrate the marriage of James Chanter and Moll Lay, two most excellent ballad singers. So you see the ballad tradition comes in there from the very start.
This piece I own was originally written for the celebrating the marriage of James Chanter and Moll Lay, two most excellent ballad singers. I have introduced the similes that are in all your celebrated operas, the swallow, the moth, the bee, the ship, the flower, etc. Besides, I have a prison scene which the ladies always reckon charmingly pathetic.
But I see it is time for us to withdraw. The actors are preparing to begin. Play away the overture.
Overture to the Beggar's Opera. Well, Jeremy Barlow, we've moved round the corner now from Lincoln's Inn Fields into Portugal Street. In fact, we're right opposite what's now the LSE. Why have you brought us here?
Well, it's at the Lincoln's Inn Theatre, the Theatre Royal, Lincoln's Inn Fields, I should say, actually fronted onto Portugal Street. There was a little alleyway connecting it with Lincoln's Inn Fields where we just were. And we're bang opposite the front entrance now, which is now actually the back entrance of the Royal College of Surgeons. And looking down to the end of the street, we can see what must be lawyers' chambers, some rather barrack-like but well-proportioned early 18th century houses. And the only picture of that, this theatre, showed a building very like those buildings down there, but unfortunately no trace remains today.
Now, the Breggers Opera, the first performance was given in 1728, wasn't
it? That's right, January 1728, yes.
And John Gay wrote the libretto. What about the music itself?
What he did was to put new words to the old ballad tunes, and he selected the ballad tunes, and in the text you can see he always heads a song, not with the title of the song, but with the title of the old ballad. And the story goes, and it may not be true, but the story goes that they were going to do it like ballad singers, completely unaccompanied, without an orchestra. But some way during rehearsals, somebody said, no, this is not going to work. And so the German-born composer, John Christopher Pepusch, was brought in at the very last minute to arrange and put accompaniments to the songs that Gay had chosen. Gay obviously loved Scottish tunes, and he uses them in a very special way towards the end of each act when the emotional tension increases. He uses these lovely Scots tunes. And another thing he does is that the beginning of each act, you feel you're just watching a play with music. There are very few songs in relation to the amount of dialogue. But as the tension increases, he reduces the amount of dialogue and increases the amount of music. And you'll hear this very clearly at the end of the first act, which is a great emotional climax. I mean, it might be just a good thing to summarise the story. We've got this anti-hero, perhaps one of the first anti-heroes, actually, Captain Macheath, a highwayman, as contrasted to, say, Julius Caesar. And Captain Macheath is a womaniser, and he's in love with the daughter of another criminal, Peacham. And Peacham, though, doesn't want his daughter marrying a criminal. And as soon as he hears that she has actually married Captain Macheath, he puts in train to have him arrested and then, of course, hanged. And Polly has overheard her parents plotting this, and Macheath, unbeknownst to them, is hidden in the house. And she imagines him going towards Tyburn and in all his glory, and in a little soliloquy. And then Macheath bursts onto the scene and almost seduces her in front of the audience.
Pretty Polly, say, when I was away, did your fancy never stray to some new
suspect my honour, my courage, suspect anything but my love. May my pistols misfire and my mare slip her shoulder while I am pursued, if I ever forsake thee.
Nay, my dear, I have no reason to doubt you, for I find in the romance you lent me, none of the great heroes were ever false in love.
My heart was so free, it wrote like a bee, till Polly my passion requited. My heart was so free, it wrote like a bee, till Polly my passion requited. I sipped each flower, I changed every hour. I sipped each flower, I changed every hour. But here every flower's united. I sipped each flower, I changed every hour. I sipped each flower, I changed every hour. But here every flower's united.
Were you sentenced to transportation? Sure, my dear, you could not leave me behind you. Could you?
Is there any power, any force that could tear me from thee? You might sooner tear a pension out of the hands of a courtier, a fee from a lawyer, a pretty woman from a looking-glass, or any woman from quadrille.
but to tear me from thee is impossible.
But I laid on Greenland's coast, and in my arms embraced my lass. Warm amidst eternal frost, too soon the half his might would pass.
Were I soon on Indian soil, soon as the burning day was closed, I could mock the sultry toil when on my travel's breast reposed.
And I would love you all the day,
every night would kiss and pray,
if with me you'd fondly stray.
Against thy life. They now, even now, are in search after thee. They are preparing evidence against thee. Thy life depends upon a moment.
My dear, is so riveted to thine that I cannot unloose my hold.
But my papa may intercept thee, and then I should lose the very glimmering of hope. A few weeks, perhaps, may reconcile us all. Shall thy Polly hear from thee?
Must I then go?
And will not absence change your love?
If you doubt it, let me stay and be hanged.
Oh, how I fear, how I tremble. Go. But when safety will give you leave, you will be sure to see me again. For till then, Polly is wretched.
The mise of us a shilling says, which is our price to pay, with sighs resigns it by degrees, and first is gone for aye.
The boy thus when his sparrow's flown, the bird in silence dies, but soon as out of sight dies,
Jeremy, it's called an opera, but how kind of operatic is it?
Well, one of the ways in which it is an opposition to Italian opera is that he uses dialogue instead of recitatives, and as I said, these short popular ballad tunes for the songs. And in fact, nearly always the singers have one syllable per note, but at one point he does actually parody the Italian operatic idiom, and he's also alluding to an incident in which the two prima donnas of the day employed by Handel in his Italian operas came to blow on the stage in a Bononcini opera. And this is when Lucy and Polly, those are the two rivals, in fact two wives of Macheath, meet and attack each other likewise on the stage, and each of them sings in a coloratura way with, for example, the word dirt has many notes to it. Instead of just dirt, it's dirt.
I think that must have brought the house down.
Why, how now, madam flirt, if you thus must chatter and the hobbling in dirt, let's try who best gets spurt. Madam flirt, why, how now, saucy jade, sure the wench is tipsy, how can you see me made? The stop of such a gypsy, saucy jade.
The impact of the Beggar's Opera, Jeremy? I mean, was it very successful?
It was an extraordinary success. It broke all theatrical records. A play or show then was considered successful if it ran for 6 or 10 performances, but the Beggar's Opera ran for 62 nights without a break. And what's more, the success continued right the way through the 18th century. Right into the 19th century, there wasn't a year in which it wasn't put on in London. It's extraordinary.
What sort of people would have gone to see it? I mean, would the upper classes have considered it a bit beneath them to see an opera about lowlife?
No, not at all. The various attacks were made on the gentry and nobility, rather slumming it in their attraction to the Beggar's Opera, but of course all classes would have gone, you know, that the pit would have been inhabited by the lower classes, and also they crammed them onto the stage then when a show was successful, right round behind the actors in a semicircle. Much of the opera is set in jail, in Newgate Jail in fact, and of course this is another allusion to prison scenes which were very frequent in Italian operas. It's set in prison and Macheath is incarcerated there but is about to be taken off to be tried, and the outcome is almost inevitable that he'll be hanged. Around him we have his two wives, Polly and Lucy, and their two fathers, Peacham, who's responsible for Macheath's arrest, and Lockett, the jailer, who is Lucy's father. And Lucy and Polly are pleading with their respective fathers for Macheath's release in these next set of songs. Macheath is so fed up that he actually says, rather than have two women, he'd almost rather be taken away and hanged.
Which way shall I turn me? How can I decide? Wife's the day or the death are as fond as a bride. One wife is too much for most husbands to hear, but two at a time there's no mortal can bear. This way and that way, and which way I will, what would come to the one t'other wife would take ill? This way and that way, and which way I will, what would come to the one t'other wife would take ill?
But if his own misfortunes have made him insensible to mine, a father sure will be more compassionate. Dear, dear sir, sink the material evidence and bring him off at his trial. Polly upon her knees begs it of you. Stress on the dashing wave. Chibnall's heart is hardened. Sure you, sir, will have more compassion on a daughter. I know the evidence is in your power. How then can you be a tyrant to me?
Time is come, Lucy. We know our own affairs, therefore let us have no more whimpering or whining.
Ourselves like the great to secure a retreat. When matters require it, must give up our gang. Ourselves like the great to secure a retreat. When matters require, must give up our gang. And good reason why, for instead of a fray, if bitter man die, like poor petty rascals might hang. Like poor petty rascals might hang. And good reason why, for instead of a fry, in Nigel can die, like poor petty rascals might hang, like poor petty rascals might hang.
Set your heart at rest, Polly. Your husband is to die today. Therefore, if you're not already provided, it is our time to look about for another. There's comfort for you, you slut.
We are ready, sir, to conduct you to the Old Bailey.
The charge is prepared, the lawyers are met, the judge is all arranged, a terrible show. I go undismayed. For death is a debt on demand, so take what I owe. Then farewell, my love, dear charmers, adieu. Contented I die, 'tis a better for you. Here ends all dispute, the rest of our lives. For this way at once I please all my wives. Then farewell, my love, dear charmers, adieu. Contented I die, 'tis a better for you. Here ends all dispute, the rest of our lives. For this way at once I please all my wives.
Macheath in Newgate Jail on his way to his trial at the Old Bailey. Jeremy, how important was the fact that Gay used familiar tunes to the audience?
I think it was very important, not only because the audience knew and loved those tunes, but also they knew the words that the tunes had been set to before, and often Gay plays on that knowledge by having contrasting words in his settings.
Yes, I'm trying to find a connection, for instance, with the song we're going to hear in a moment from The Beggar's Opera. This is Peacham. He's actually cursing the profession of lawyers, which must have been quite funny for any lawyers in the audience. But in fact, first of all,
We'll hear one of the original ballads set to the same tune. The tune's actually originally called A Soldier and a Sailor, but this ballad is called The Saint Turned Sinner. It's subtitled The Parson Under the Quaker's Petticoats.
Was so faint, this jolly handsome Quaker, as he did overtake her, she made his mouth to water, and thought long to be at her. Such, sir, is no great matter, accounted by a saint. Says he, my pretty creature, your charming handsome feature has set me all on fire, you know what I desire. There is no harm in love, there is no harm in love. Well, see, if that's your notion, to preach up such devotion, such hopeful guides as you, sir, will half the world undo, sir. A halter is your due, sir, if you such tricks approve. The parson, still more eager than lustful Turk or Niger, took up a lower garment and swore there was no harm in't, according to the text, according to the text. But Solomon, more wiser than any dull adviser, had many hundred misses, and why should such as this is make you so sadly vexed, make you so sadly vexed?
Your health and pence, sir. You don't rob your chest, sir. Your wife may steal your rest, sir. A thief your goods and plight. A thief your goods and plight. But this is all but picking with race, pence, chest, and chicking. He ever was a creature, his lawyers and his feet. He steals your whole estate. He steals your whole estate.
A song from the Beggar's Opera, and before that, a broadside ballad. The same popular tune, otherwise known as A Soldier and a Sailor. Well, as luck, or possibly design, would have it, in our exploration of the origins of the Beggar's Opera, Jeremy Barlow and I have ended our little tour around Lincoln's Inn Fields in a hostelry, a pub in Portugal Street. Jeremy, politics is quite a sort of central theme to the Beggar's Opera. Obviously, there is this element of satire on Italian opera, which we've been discussing. But tell me something more about the political statement that Gabe was making.
Yes, well, on the first night, Sir Robert Walpole, England's Whig Prime Minister, and actually the country's first Prime Minister, was there in the audience. Gay was a Tory, and along with his colleagues, Pope and Swift, was attacking the cronyism and sleaze, nothing's new, of Walpole's government. And he does this in the Beggar's Opera, and the audience actually really got that much more than they got the satire on Italian opera, as far as one can tell. He does it in various ways. One thing he does, he keeps on slipping in the word great and great man and great statesman. Now, Walpole, who was very tall, was known as the great man, ironically perhaps, and all these allusions really hit their target. And in fact, in one number, the audience was so keen on the fact that it attacked Walpole that they encored it. And Walpole is said, in a typically adroit move, to have encored it again in order to make it seem that he wasn't offended. But actually, he was highly offended. And when Gay wrote a sequel, Polly, Walpole had it banned by his censor.
So the legacy of the Beggar's Opera was Polly, as you say, was banned. But there were other ballad-type operas to follow, weren't there? Although, were any of them as successful?
They were successful, but they were very different, because they were all, the ones that came afterwards, apart from Polly, they were all short pieces. They were done as afterpieces after a main theatre production. And some were reasonably successful, but none had anything like the success of the Beggar's Opera.
Well, we're going to go into what, in fact, is are the last three airs, or arias, I suppose you could call them, of the Beggar's Opera. One of them particularly does sort of refer specifically to the political climate of the day, doesn't it? And that's the tune of Greensleeves.
Yes, if we remember, Macheath has been taken off to be tried. He's tried, found guilty, and he's now in the condemned hold. He's alternately terrified and then puts on a show of bravado. And while he's doing so, he's drinking, as we are here, more and more, and getting himself thoroughly drunk. And eventually, in a mood of defiance, he says these words, and these, again, are an allusion to Walpole's corruption. "Since laws were made for every degree to curb vice in others, as well as me, I wonder we hadn't better company upon Tyburn Tree." That's the gallows.
Okay, well, let's hear the last three airs from the Beggar's Opera. Jeremy Barlow, thanks very much.
"Since laws were made for every degree to curb vice in others as well as me, I wonder we had better company upon Tyburn Tree. Since laws were made for every degree to curb vice in others as well as me, I wonder we had better company upon Tyburn Tree. But gold from law can take out the sting, and if rich men like us were to swing, 'twould thin the land such numbers to string upon Tyburn Tree. But gold from law can take out the sting, and if rich men like us were to swing, 'twould thin the land such numbers to string upon Tyburn Tree."
"Some friends of yours, Captain, desire to be admitted. I'll leave you together.
For my having broke prison, you see, gentlemen, I am ordered immediate execution. The sheriff's officers, I believe, are now at the door. That Jemmy Twitcher should peach me, I own, surprise me. 'Tis a plain proof that the world is all alike, and that even our gang can no more trust one another than other people. Therefore, I beg you, gentlemen, look well to yourselves, for in all probability you may live some months longer."
"We are heartily sorry, Captain, for your misfortune. Yeah. But 'tis what we must all come to."
"Peachum and Lockett, you know, are infamous scoundrels. Their lives are as much in your power as yours are in theirs. Remember, your dying friend, 'tis my last request. Bring those villains to the gallows before you, and I am satisfied."
"We'll do it."
"Aye."
"Miss Polly and Miss Lucy entreat a word with you."
"Gentlemen, adieu." "My dear Lucy, my dear Polly, whatsoever hath passed between us is now at an end. If you are fond of marrying again, the best advice I can give you is to ship yourselves off for the West Indies, where you'll have a fair chance of getting a husband apiece, or by good luck, two or three, as you like best."
"How can I support this sight? There is nothing moves one so much as a great man in distress."
Thank you.
Four women more, Captain, with a child apiece. See, here they come.
What? Four wives more? This is too much! Here, tell the sheriff's officers I am ready.
But honest friend, I hope you don't intend that Macheath shall be really executed.
Most certainly, sir. To make the peace perfect, I was for doing strict poetical justice. Macheath is to be hanged. And for the other personages of the drama, the audience must have supposed that they were all either hanged or transported.
Why then, friend, this is a downright deep tragedy. The catastrophe is manifestly wrong, for an opera must end happily.
Your objection, sir, is very just and is easily removed. For you must allow that in this kind of drama, 'tis no matter how absurdly things are brought about. So, you rabble there, run and cry reprieve. Let the prisoner be brought back to his wives in triumph.
All this we must do to comply with the taste of the town.
Through the whole piece, you may observe such a similitude of manners in high and low life that it is difficult to determine whether, in the fashionable vices, the fine gentleman imitate the gentleman of the road, or the gentleman of the road, the fine gentleman. Had the play remained as I at first intended, it would have carried a most excellent moral. 'Twould have shown that the lower sort of people have their vices in a degree as well as the rich, and that they are punished for them.
So it seems I'm not left to my choice, but must have a wife at last. Look ye, my dears, we will have no controversy now. Let us give this day to mirth. And I am sure she who thinks herself my wife will testify her joy by a dance.
Dance, dance.
Ladies, I hope you will give me leave to present a partner to each of you. And, if I may without offence, for this time I take Polly for mine. And for life, you slut. For we were really married. As for the rest, but at present, keep your own secret.
Thus I stand like the Turk with his doxies around, from all sides their glances his passion compound. For black, brown and fair his inconstancy burns, and the different beauties subdue him by turns. Calls forth her charms to provoke his desires, though willing to all with but one he retires. But think of his maxim and put off your sorrow. The wretch of today may be happy tomorrow.
Final moments from The Beggar's Opera, performed by Adrian Thompson, Charles Daniels, Sarah Walker, Bronwyn Mills, Richard Jackson and Anne Dawson, with Bob Hoskins as the beggar and Ian Caddy as the player. The Broadside Band was directed by Jeremy Barlow, who was also Lucy Skeeping's guest in today's Early Music Show. The producer in Manchester was Chris Wines.
Here on BBC Radio 3, a new season of Monday Lunchtime Concerts, live from Wigmore Hall in London. Top international artists, of course, like the Tokash Quartet. The singers, Soile Isakoski and Mark Padmore. The instrumentalists, Ilya Gringolds and Sabina Meyer. And chamber music from the Scampa, Tokyo and Emerson Quartets. The season begins this Monday with a violinist who dazzled audiences at this year's proms, Alina Ibragimova. The BBC Radio 3 Lunchtime Concerts, live from Wigmore Hall in London, Monday lunchtimes at 1 o'clock.
It's coming up to 2 minutes past two, and now for a repeat of last Monday's BBC Proms Chamber Concert. It's presented by Catherine Bott.
Welcome to Cadogan Hall for the last of this season's Proms Chamber Music Recitals. Or perhaps I should say, welcome to Venice, because that's where today's music takes us, our gondola steered most capably by the members of the French ensemble Le Poème Harmonique, under the direction of theorbo player Vincent Dumestre. Their programme is called Venice from the Streets to the Palaces, and it celebrates the artistic melting pot that was La Serenissima in the early heady days of the 17th century, which coincided with the birth of a new musical expression that led swiftly to that most exotic and irrational art form, opera. I could call this concert a mere curtain raiser to the 400th anniversary performance of Monteverdi's Vespers of 1610, which is coming up on Friday to fill the penultimate night of the proms, but it's much, much more than that. We are going to be treated to a candlelit semi-staging of the affetti, the emotions, from the loftiest romance to the streetwise Bergamasca. Here's a very good one, The Boat Passengers. It's the story of a Frenchman, a German, a Spaniard, and a Neapolitan, among others, who set sail with a boatload of victuals and then find the ship's cat has eaten all the cheese. There will be music by Monteverdi to start the programme, including his heartfelt Lamento della Ninfa. But there's also rarely heard music by his contemporaries Benedetto Ferrari and Francesco Manelli, the first composer to write operas for a paying public rather than a courtly audience. With me on stage to talk about the programme is Vincent Agrèche, who is General Manager of Le Poème Harmonique. Vincent, thank you very much for talking to us today. Tell me about the concept of this programme.
Well, first, maybe it would be interesting to reset this concert in the frame of what Le Poème Harmonique is doing generally. Le Poème Harmonique was founded approximately 10 years ago by artistic director Vincent Dumestre. And since the very beginning, the aim of the group was to create a kind of combination between the various arts of the 17th century, which means music, of course, but also literature, poetry, theater, dance. So the group developed on both sides concerts and established itself throughout the world with quite renowned concert programs of both profanous and sacred music, and also progressively developed some stage productions, most of them with one of the most brilliant young French directors, Benjamin Lazare. And the aim of these stage productions was to give to the audience a kind of global understanding of the arts of the 17th century, just like you would talk about period instruments performing, but having the same type of approach with the gesture, the pronunciation, the sets, costumes, and the lights. And so we are now performing in France regularly important operatic productions under these principles. But it's not so easy to bring abroad operatic productions all the time, so we wanted to imagine a concert frame that will be a kind of reduction of these principles to their very essence. So Vincent Dumestre and Benjamin Lazare imagined together this program about Venetian music, which of course features music by Monteverdi and Manelli, as you said, but set them in the frame of a reconstruction of the gesture of the time and use the dramatic power of the light of the time, which was in the theaters and the concert hall, the candles. So what unfortunately the BBC listeners won't be able to see is that this concert is going to take place nearly in the dark, only with the candlelight, and this light is going to emphasize the gesture of the singers and the interaction they have with the musical performers.
Well, I'm sure all radio listeners are now geared up to use their imaginations, and the lucky people here in Cadogan Hall can use their eyes as well. Vincent Agrèche, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So now, as the lights dim, we can all settle back and let the musical waters lap gently round us as we welcome Le Poème Harmonique to perform an hour-long sequence of ravishing Venetian music. And they begin with Monteverdi, an aria from his opera Il Ritorno d'Ulisse in Patria. Dormo ancora. Do I still sleep, or am I awake?
respiro e chi terren calpesto. Dormo ancora, dormo ancora, dormo ancora, o son desco, chi fece ne chi feci sempre oggi, delusi in che vo sonno, ministro de parmenti, chi cancioli non riposi di ria sventura, qual vita di torvi enti a
Oh, my God.